Welcome to Australia's Future with Tony Abbott. I'm Daniel Wilde from the Institute of Public Affairs. Australia is facing its most significant challenges since World War II. Geopolitical tensions are increasing, cultural self-confidence is in decline. The values which define us, freedom, democracy, egalitarianism, and sacrifice, are being put to the test. Over this special podcast series, Tony and I discuss how Australia can survive and flourish in the decades ahead. Well, hello, Tony, and g'day to all of our listeners. Lovely to be back for another episode of Australia's Future with Tony Abbott. Today, we'll be doing a retrospective on the very successful Abbott government, and then from a good government to a bad government, we'll be talking about the Andrews government and its legacy in Victoria and across Australia. And we'll finish off with a chat about the voice to Parliament, as early voting has already commenced across the nation. Tony, great to be with you again for a chat.
Dan, wonderful to be with you, and congratulations on the increase in the family.
Thank you. Yes, so our absence was due to my wife giving birth to our second child, so we're very happy and everyone's healthy and happy, and thank you very much, Tony. Appreciate that. Okay, let's kick off with your government. Recently, it was a 10-year anniversary of your election. I just very briefly want to remind our viewers and listeners of what an achievement it was to form government. In 2013, you delivered 90 seats for the coalition, up from 65 in 2007. So you netted 25 seats across just two cycles. But what's more remarkable to me and what people forget is the primary vote of the coalition. You got it to 46% compared to Labor's 33%. Now, in 2016, one election later, the coalition's primary vote went down to 42%. And in 2022, it hit just 36%. So from 46 to 36 in less than a decade. Now, some people will say, well, okay, but Tony was operating with a different electoral map. He didn't have the Teals. He didn't have the Greens in the same way. But I just had a quick look at this. Even if you take out the two seats which the Greens took from the Liberals, which is Ryan and Brisbane, you take out the six new Teal seats, Curtin, McKellar, Goldstein, North Sydney, Kooyong and Wentworth. So let's say that we take those out of your map, you still get 82. Mm-hmm. In 2013, so a comfortable majority no matter which way you look at this. So it's important to remind people that it was a big victory, and I just want you to take us back to that moment when you had commentators like David Marr, you know, saying Australia doesn't want Tony Abbott, we never have. So that's the elitist sentiment. You've got the mainstream backing you in. Tell us a bit about that dynamic that was happening.
Well, Dan, thank you. Look, it was a wonderful victory, and it was a really thumping win on a par with John Howard in 1996, and almost as big as Malcolm Fraser under the very different circumstances of 1976. So a great day for the coalition, a great day for the centre-right, and as I said on the night, Australia is once more open for business, and that was the objective. And in 2 years, we got a lot done. The problem we had was we had a very difficult Senate, mm-hmm. notwithstanding the fact that there was notionally a centre-right majority with the election of the Palmer senators and a couple of sort of right-leaning independents.
Yep.
And when you're trying to put difficult reforms into place, and the 2014 budget was the last serious attempt at economic reform in our country, inevitably you sink in the polls. And I guess we had some nervous backbenchers, and we had some ambitious frontbenchers who thought that they'd do better with a change of prime minister. But a lot was done in just 2 years. We did stop the boats. We did make a very good start to budget repair, even though we weren't able to get all of the reforms that we wanted through the Senate. We did get the three big free trade deals done that had been languishing for a decade. We did start a massive infrastructure build,
yep.
Some of which we are only now starting to see come to fruition, like the Western Sydney Airport, the big road projects in our major capitals, except Melbourne.
Yes.
You know, where Dan Andrews spent $1 billion not to build the road that yep. the Commonwealth and the state were cooperating on. And we scrapped the carbon tax and the mining tax. And these are the first big new taxes that have actually been abolished.
That's right.
I mean, every time a new tax has previously been introduced, whatever might have been said about it at the time, they've all survived. They've all survived. Yes, but they've been tinkered with perhaps. Mm-hmm. But these are the only two new taxes that have ever been abolished. So it was I think, a very busy, very successful 2 years. We made a good start on boosting our nation's defences. It was unfortunate that we then dithered for a few years over our new submarine deterrent. It's unfortunate that the build-up funded by the increase to 2% of GDP in defence spending hasn't been faster, but nevertheless, a lot of good things happened, and the greatest honour and privilege of my life was leading our party and then leading our nation, and I will be forever grateful, and I just wish that it had lasted longer. But them's the breaks of politics and public life.
I'm not just saying this to blow smoke up you, but if you go through the comments on our YouTube page or Facebook, basically every second or third comment is, you know, Tony reminds me of a great prime minister and when are you coming back and so forth. So I think that a lot of people out there certainly appreciate the work of your government.
And Dan, look, I was very honoured that a couple of weeks back in Sydney there was a big dinner to mark the 10th anniversary of the election of the Abbott government, and about 600 people turned up. Peter Dutton made a wonderful speech which was extracted in Spectator.
That's right, yep.
And look, it was a great occasion, but I suppose hanging over the occasion was this sense of what more there might have been had things panned out differently. I mean, I will always regret the fact that a government which should have been as good as the Howard government turned out to be less than it should have been. But again, I stress, these are the breaks of politics. Public life is not fair. And rather than lament the fact that it only lasted for 2 years, I should cherish the fact that it happened at all. And that's the great honour of my life.
Yes. Thanks for that, Tony. Look, I think that when you look at the opposition that you brought into government, and I think certainly the early days of government, it was certainly an example of leadership. I think back in when you became opposition leader in 2009, there were a lot of critics out there, particularly in the media and the usual elites, who were saying that, you know, Tony's unelectable, we have to go with the carbon tax, you can't stop the boats and all this kind of stuff. And there are not many people that would have kept going. It would have been, I assume, a lot of people would have been at you to say, look, Tony, how about you dial it back a bit? But I think it is a testament that you provided the leadership. And that's what we've seen. I mean, I think one of Dutton's great contributions has been to go no on The Voice. He would have had people around him saying, just vote yes, it's easier. And it shows what leadership in public debate can do. And you provided that. So tell us a bit about the importance of leadership.
Well, you make a very good point, Dan. And I think there's been an object lesson to people on the centre-right in Peter Dutton's opposition to The Voice. When Peter decided to oppose The Voice, it still had something like 60% support in the polls. Now it's got less than 40% support in the polls. And this is what happens when you make a decision based on principle and argument.
Yep.
And because he was prepared to take a stand based on principle and mount a good argument in support of it, Peter Dutton, along with Jacinda Price, Warren Mundine and others,
yep,
has helped to turn an apparently popular position into a very unpopular position,
yep,
for the long-term benefit, I believe, of our country. Yep. And look, if I go back to my time, you're right. Everyone thought that the carbon tax was an expression of the wave of the future. People despaired of our ability to stop the boats. And yes, there was a lot of advice saying go soft on both policies, don't make commitments that are too hard and that you might be judged against if they don't work out. And I thought, look, the Howard government stopped the boats. It's been done before. It can be done again. Yes, there were more of them. The circumstances were more difficult. The people smugglers were smarter and all the rest of it. But I knew we would find a way to do it. And we absolutely did, particularly when we gave the boat people whose boats had been scuttled an unsinkable orange life raft to go back to Java in. And on the carbon tax, well, it was plainly socialism masquerading as environmentalism, plainly. And always we've seen that people are in favour of emissions reduction when it's almost costless.
Yep.
But once they realise that there are heavy costs to the emissions obsession, they suddenly see all this in a rather different light, as I think is increasingly becoming obvious again.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did back then, and what I think is a good lesson for political parties everywhere, I adopted what I thought was the right policy. I developed what I thought were the strongest possible arguments for our policy, and I was absolutely relentless in arguing for our policy day in, day out. Because as John Howard famously said, you can't fatten a pig on market day, and you can't expect to announce a policy a few weeks out from an election and get it through to the electorate. All of your big policy positions need to be very clear months, if not years, before an election.
Well, thanks for that, Tony. And we'll go from what was a very good government to now a very bad government here in Victoria. Well, the government still is very bad and continues, but without its former leader, Daniel Andrews, who recently resigned as Premier and also resigning from Parliament. There were so many things about this government in this period of time, I think, in Victoria's history that are shameful and regrettable. Just very briefly on the economic situation, we released research not long ago showing that Victoria is the highest taxing state in the nation, the fastest growing state government spending, the fastest growing public sector wages, and the fastest growing public sector workforce in Australia. It's also the only state to have a net outflow of business formation, and a net outflow of people leaving the state, fleeing the state. So this is a state that is on the edge. That's sort of the fiscal, but look at what they've done to our democracy. They've effectively implemented a gerrymander with what they've been doing with the electoral boundaries. Melbourne, which is the beating heart of the state, is just a shadow of its former self. There's so many things that are wrong and hopefully can be fixed. But Tony, I'd be interested in your assessment of the Andrews government and Andrews legacy.
Yeah, well, plainly, Daniel Andrews was much better at politics than he was at government, because he was politically very successful for 9 years, but the government was pretty much a shocker. You look at the ultimate results of the Andrews government, you've got a budget disaster, you've got deteriorating services, and you've got a debauched, if not corrupted, public service.
Yep.
And institutions more generally. So it was a very, very bad result. And interestingly, the moment he announced his resignation, it was as if the spell suddenly lifted. You'll recall the footage from a couple of weeks back of the grand final lunch where Eddie Maguire announced that the Premier was resigning, and the room erupted in spontaneous cheering. And these were people who, until very recently, would have fawned over the government, because if you wanted to get anywhere in Dan Andrews' Victoria,
yep,
you had to toe the line. You absolutely had to toe the line. And this is how quickly the political mood can change. I think you've got to give credit even to your political opponents, even to the political opponents of whom you are very critical.
Mm.
In his own way, Dan Andrews has lived a life of public service by his own lights, and so I suppose we've got to give credit to him for that. But I suspect that his will be a premiership which was very successful while it lasted, but which rapidly seems highly unsuccessful once it's over. Bob Carr had a bit the same problem in New South Wales. Now, Bob Carr was, I think, a much better premier than Daniel Andrews.
Yep.
He was in the Labor right rather than the Labor left tradition. But still, it was a time of of squandered opportunities. We marked time rather than made the most of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And given his great political gifts, because he really was an extremely accomplished politician, Bob Kay, to this day he's still a very accomplished and effective advocate, even though I disagree with him more now than I was inclined to back then. But the Carr premiership doesn't look so great in retrospect, and I think the Andrews premiership will look dreadful in retrospect.
Yeah, that's right, Tony. And I think what was interesting living here throughout it is you mentioned how all the sort of major, the captains of industry and the major institutions were all in thrall to the government. And what was actually quite scary is how fast it can happen.
Mm.
Look, I think Victoria has always, you know, for a long time has had challenges in a way that other states perhaps do not. But it happened throughout COVID very quickly. The media, corporates, places of worship, everybody fell into line.
It was such a miserable time in our national life. And I think it's clearer and clearer as time goes by that it wasn't the disease that was the real problem. It was the policy to deal with the disease, and it was such a dreadful overreaction. After that initial lockdown, which perhaps had some justification, we really should not have basically stopped normal life for the best part of two and a half years. It was just dead wrong. And the brutality with which it was done, particularly here in Victoria, where you had the police firing rubber bullets and tear gas at protesters, when you had those running street battles through Melbourne, when you had those dreadful instances of decent, innocent people like our friend, the pregnant woman up in Ballarat, being arrested for the most trivial of reasons. I mean, it was a very dispiriting time, and I don't think it was our nation at anything like its best.
And I think it goes back to what we were talking about before, which is the importance of leadership. Mm. There was a lack of leadership in civil society to voice an alternative. I mean, I'm proud that the IPA was out there. We were
almost,
out there early.
Almost alone, Dan, almost alone. The IPA as an institution was an early opponent of the policy. Not one of our parliaments, not the federal parliament, not any of the state parliaments, properly debated the policy, properly argued for it and against it. The whole thing was just done with a degree of automaticity almost.
Yep.
And for something as vast in terms of the intrusion of government into our lives, the expansion of government, the restrictions on freedom, there should have been a proper debate. At least in Britain, there was quite a vigorous dissent
a lot of backbenchers
in the parliament against the lockdowns of the Boris Johnson government. There were significant public figures like Lord Sumption speaking very strongly and very early against the overturning of cherished historic freedoms, but there was almost none of that here. So look, it was a very unedifying time in our national life, and I just wish more people in authority had been prepared to speak with more courage.
Yeah, and I think our job now is to basically make sure that we learn the lessons from it and remind people of what happened, because that's all we can do now.
And I suspect that one of the reasons why Daniel Andrews suddenly decided to go was because he'd had an assurance from the Prime Minister that the National Commission of Inquiry would not look into the actions of the states.
Isn't that shocking, though?
Given that it was the actions of the states that were responsible for most of the trauma of that time.
Yeah. It's dodgy as.
What's the point of having an inquiry if it's not able to look at most of the things that were done in the name of countering the pandemic?
That's it. Look, Tony, I think we should return to this after The Voice. Mm-hmm. I mean, the IPA has some work in train basically as a recounting the Andrews period, so for the purpose of informing the future. Mm-hmm. So we'll talk about this a bit more. Look, you are a busy man and you're jetting across the country, so we'll get on to our final topic, which is The Voice.
Mm-hmm.
Voting's already underway across the country. The in-person voting will be next Saturday, so not long to go. Tony, we might be able to squeeze one more in next week, chat with you, or maybe not. You might be around. We'll see what we can do.
See what we can do.
Right, but this might be the last one. So give us your message. What's your pitch to the country?
Well, my first pitch is that this really matters. It really matters. Referendums and constitutional change or potential constitutional change, they're for keeps in a way elections aren't. You can change a bad government, you can change a bad law, but if you make a big mistake in your constitution, you're stuck with it virtually forever. So let's get this right. And I've got to say that the proposed voice is absolutely wrong in principle, and it would be pretty dreadful in practice. It would entrench race in our constitution. It would gum up our government even more, and it would reinforce the separatism which is at the heart of Indigenous disadvantage. It's by far the biggest change to our constitution that we've ever been asked to make. Some distinguished constitutional lawyers, and these are not well-known conservatives, these are academics, the professors of constitutional law at Sydney and Queensland universities, Professors Gerangelos and Aroni, they say that giving the voice a whole new chapter of the constitution and giving it the sweeping rights to make representations to everyone on everything effectively creates a fourth arm of government.
Yep.
It's a very, very big change. And there's another paper just out from Professor Aroni saying not only is this voice going to be a fourth arm of government, but it could, by stealth, substantially expand the legislative powers of the Commonwealth vis-a-vis the states, given that the proposed section 129.3 of the Constitution says that the Commonwealth Parliament will have power to make laws to make laws in respect of the representations of the voice. So there are vast ramifications here which have hardly been thought through.
Yeah.
Now, the Prime Minister, who I think is a little desperate looking at the polls, who was previously maximising the voice as this golden new dawn, this wonderful new maturity transforming moment, is now minimising the voice. Look, it's just an advisory committee. Well, wrong. Nowhere in the proposed constitutional change does it say this is just an advisory committee.
Mm-hmm.
Nowhere does it say that the Parliament and the government will be free to accept or reject the so-called advice. This is a massive change. And as we've seen in the operation of environmental law, a statutory, let alone a constitutional, right to be consulted is being used by activist judges to stop major resource developments all over the country, most recently the $16 billion Scarborough gas field a couple of hundred kilometres off the coast of Western Australia,
yep,
on the grounds of alleged lack of consultation with Indigenous people. Just one, it seems, just one, the land council of which the applicant was previously part, had approved the development, but just one, Indigenous objector on the grounds of interference with whale songlines, would you believe, has been able to stop a $16 billion project, vital, vital for our economic security, indeed our national security going forward. The voice is going to immeasurably reinforce all of this, and bring it into the whole gamut of our national life. It's fundamentally anti-democratic because it's essentially giving 3 and a bit% of our population a greatly disproportionate say over how government operates based on ancestry. It's just wrong.
Well, Tony, thank you very much for that assessment, and we'll have to leave it there because I know you've got to duck off. So appreciate your time, appreciate the chat as always, and we'll be in touch soon for another chat.
We will be, Dan. Thanks.
This is a production of the Centre for the Australian Way of Life at the Institute of Public Affairs. To find out more, visit australia.ipa.org.au.